would bring you forth by a strong hand and redeem you from the house of bondage, from the hand of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. So know, so you shall know that Yahweh, your God, He is the God. The God who is the faithful one, the faithful God, Ha'el Ha'ne'eman, the faithful God, keeping the covenant and the covenant loyalty for those that love Him and observe His commandments unto a thousand generations. So we have here a constant reference in the Sinaitic legislation, in the Sinaitic covenant, of continued enmeshment, intertwining with God's covenant making with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the fulfillment of those promises to deliver the children of Israel from Egyptian slavery, to make them numerous, multiply them, to bless them, to give them the land of promise, the land of Israel, and to take them as a special treasure from all the peoples of the earth. In order to be a people, they need a way of governing themselves, a way of behaving, a set of laws that become incorporated into it, and this, of course, is what we call the Torah. Now, there are special features to ancient Near Eastern covenants. There is a certain kind of structure, and I think that it would be helpful for us to understand certain things, but I want to clarify what I'm going to say prior to that. Well, first of all, let me clarify one more thing, add one more thing to what I had just said, and that is, again, another connective between God's promise to Abraham that his descendants would inherit the land of Canaan. Okay? This is a covenant promise to Abraham in Genesis chapter 15. So, in part of the Torah, which is the Sinai covenant, we see throughout the book of Deuteronomy this theme of the children of Israel inheriting the promised land, the land promised to Abraham and his descendants forever, only if they observe the law of Moses. Okay? So we see in a number of places, including chapter 11, verse 19 through verse 21, okay, God says, God inspires Moses to tell the children of Israel that you shall teach the commandments of the Torah, the Sinaitic covenant, to your children, to discuss them, to deliberate upon them, to drill them into the minds and hearts of your children, to instruct them diligently. Okay? Well, sit in your home, and while you walk on the way, and when you lie down to go to bed, and when you rise up in the morning, I'm paraphrasing here, okay, and you shall write them upon the doorposts of your house and upon your gates. Now, I'll be more literal in my translation here of verse 21, which is the key verse I wish to speak about right now. In order that, in other words, you're to do all of this meditating and teaching of the commandments, well, for lots of reasons. First of all, to be a righteous and good person, to do God's will, but here in this context, it says, in order that you may multiply, which is a promise God made to Abraham, in order that you were, let me back up here. In this verse, verse 11 of Deuteronomy, wait, getting a little tongue-tied here. In Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 21, it says, in order that your days may be multiplied, and the days of your children upon the ground, which Yahweh, the God of your forefathers, swore to give to them, as the days of the heavens are over the earth. So, this here again, the Sinai covenant cannot be separated from the Abrahamic covenant. In other words, in order to receive the fruits of the Abrahamic covenant, you've got to obey the Sinai Torah. You've got to do all of these Sinaitic commandments in order for that Abrahamic covenant to be operative. So one cannot do without the other. Now, there are many, many statements throughout the Deuteronomy which say essentially the same thing. So, what I would like to suggest is that there really is no bifurcation, no separating of the eternal covenant that God made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, their descendants forever, and for that matter, as we saw in Genesis chapter 17 last time, with people that aren't physically descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but who joined the covenant. There's no separating of this Abrahamic covenant from the legislation of the Torah, in its fundamental basis, at least anyway. Now, so what we really have is a filling out of the covenant, a blossoming of the covenant, bringing to full realization the covenant in the teaching of Moses. Now, covenants are formal agreements. They're not gentlemen's agreements, as is spoken of in American speech. For an example of what I mean by a gentleman's agreement, which the Torah is not, would be something like the following. Okay, two baseball teams get together, and it's drizzling out, it's a little bit of rain, so they're not sure how long the game is going to last. So they shake hands and they make a gentleman's agreement that when it starts raining hard, whatever that is, they will wait 30 minutes, and if it continues to rain hard, they will call the game, and whoever's ahead wins, and so on. Okay, shake hands, say, or they do whatever that knuckle thing is that people do lately, okay, and they say, yeah, okay, gentleman's agreement. There's no vow, there's no consequences for disobeying the agreement, there's no solemn oath that is taken, God's name is not invoked. It's simply a friendly neighborhood convenience to agree on something. And also, what waning heart is versus waning lightly or waning in a medium way isn't really defined by anybody, okay? If it starts waning more intensely than it had at the start of the game, then they might discuss and give various opinions about whether the reins are now hard or whether they're just mediocre and at what point they're going to call the game. And they'll play it by ear. This is not a covenant. This is an agreement of some sort, but it is not a covenant. A covenant has a very definite in the ancient Near East. I, following the vast majority of contemporary scholars, whether they're people who believe in God or people who don't believe in God, unfortunately, believe mirrors in some ways the biblical Sinaitic covenant. Now, I want to reiterate here very clearly my opinion as a scholar of the Hebrew Bible with some background in ancient Near Eastern religion, that while there are many facets of law and custom and manners of speech in the Hebrew Bible that do have a ancient Near Eastern legal background and cultural background, the laws Moses, really given by God through Moses, and the commandments, all the commandments of the Torah, quite distinctive, and have features that are drastically different, important features that are drastically different than, let's say, the Code of Hammurabi or the Middle Assyrian laws or the Code of Eshnunna and other Middle Eastern legal codes and other Near Eastern covenants. So when I'm talking about these ancient Near Eastern styles of writing of covenants, I'm in no way whatsoever mean to suggest that the Torah, which I believe is divine revelation, is somehow just a second-hand copy of other things that were going on in the ancient Near East. This is certainly not so, and that is a whole other talk, and that would be important for a topic to address at some future date. But I just wanted to reiterate that when I'm talking about ancient Near Eastern backgrounds to covenant and how that affects our interpretation of the Sinaitic covenant, that I'm not implying that the Sinaitic covenant is just a human document and just sort of a rehash of other stuff going on in the ancient Near East. This is certainly not so. So with that disclaimer, let me proceed with describing what I think is the structure of the Sinaitic covenant. Now, one other preface to that is this, that there is no code law no legal code of the ancient Near East except the law of Moses that claims to be a direct revelation from God. Even the code of Hammurabi does not claim that God inspired Hammurabi with the laws. It simply makes the claim that Hammurabi had the favor of the gods and that the gods gave Hammurabi the kind of wisdom that was needed to put together his law code. Whereas the inspiration, according to the law of Moses, is much more direct. It says, and God spoke to Moses and speak to the children of Israel and command them to say such and such and, you know, and do such and such and so on and so forth. Okay? So that's number one. Number two, the laws and the laws of Moses, even where that has some sort of a cultural relationship to other ancient Near Eastern law, and some of it, in my opinion, does, it reforms ancient Near Eastern law when it does. So, for example, it's compared to the Code of Hammurabi. There are a number of instances where the cause of women is advanced much more than it is in the Code of Hammurabi. Slaves are treated muchly, and all human persons in the Torah are treated as human beings. Even foreigners, non-Israelites, people outside the covenant are treated as human beings, made in the image and likeness of God, therefore worthy of respect, and each man is judged, each human being, male or female, are judged according to their deeds, and not according to what their social status happens to be. In the Code of Hammurabi, by contrast, basically the ones that are treated as human beings under the law are only the landed male gentry, male property owners, and especially married male property owners. So with those caveats in mind, let's proceed to take a look at the formal structure of the covenant that God gave through Moses. Now, for several decades, something that scholars have is that the book of Deuteronomy particularly seems to be written with certain features, a certain practical external structure as other ancient Near Eastern covenants. Now, these other ancient Near Eastern covenants were entirely political documents. So, for example, in the so-called Amana letters, or Amana type of legislation, there is correspondence between the king of Egypt and the king of the Hittites. Well, apparently the Hittites and the Egyptians ratified a political treaty, sort of a non-aggression pact, and they structured it with a kind of formal outline as a legal document. And the formal structure went something like this. It parties, the first part, named the parties to the covenant. Okay. Then it recounted the the relationship between the parties that existed in the past. And in these particular ancient Near Eastern political covenants, you know, they would tend to skip over some of the more terrible behaviors that went on the part of both parties and just tell about all the wonderful things that they did for each other in the past. And then they would go on at some length about this. And then the next part of the covenant would be to give general requirements. Nothing too specific, but general requirements for the covenant to be established and maintained. So in some sense, these became like broad principles of the covenant, so forth. And then it would be followed by more specific prescriptions, more specific behavioral requirements of each party. And following that would be a section that would state that the witnesses to the covenant were the following, and usually it was a long list of pagan gods. Sometimes in some of these covenants, heaven and earth would be called forth as a witness as well. Sometimes the moon would be called forth as a witness, and so forth. And then if a party broke the covenant, broke the this political agreement, the whole long list of curses was heaped upon the breaker of the covenant. But if the party to the covenant, who fulfilled the covenant, continued to fulfill the covenant, they would get a list of blessings which were enumerated in the covenant. And then a provision was made in these covenants for periodic reading of the covenant to the public, both, for example, this would have happened both in the Hittite territory and in Egypt. In there are Mesopotamian covenants, there are Sumerian covenants, okay, and so wherever this covenant making went on, the officials in charge of this covenant would read the covenant to the public, so the public understood well the seriousness of the covenant and the consequences of breaking the covenant. And then finally, a provision was made in the covenant for the depositing of the covenant writing. A copy of the covenant writing would be deposited in the chief temple of the chief god of each of the parties. Now, again, most of these covenants really had to do with politics. Some of these treaties were not parallel treaties, but were called suzerainty treaties, meaning a suzerain or a top king who had made lower kings feudal lords, subjects. They would keep them. For example, the king of Akkad, okay, who conquered certain areas of Mesopotamia, north of the kingdom of Sumer, okay, subdued a number of other kings, and instead of kicking those kings out completely or executing them, he allowed those other kings to have a certain kind of governorship over those local territories, as long as they would swear loyalty to the king of Akkad. As long as they would remain at peace and remain in his coalition and recognize the king of Akkad as the chief of kings, literally as the king of kings, the king who is above all other kings. And so they would make a cut that would recognize the chief king of Akkad in this case as the suzerain, that is the boss of the whole political arrangement. And yet, in his kindness, supposedly, the king of Akkad would allow these other provincial kings to continue to have the title king and continue to govern their own lands in a sort of semi-demilitarized way. And in return for this fealty, this loyalty of the smaller local kingships, the main king, the suzerain, would provide economic benefits, more food, more agricultural and rights, more trade rights, and would also pledge military protection to the smaller kingdoms if the smaller kingdoms were invaded by a third party. So this forms some of the cultural background, some of the cultural language of the ancient Near East that we find in the Torah. Now, the Torah, of course, is radically different in several respects, not only in terms of this or that law about slavery, or this or that law about property, or this or that law about the growing ox, but in its whole warp and woof, the Torah is quite different. First of all, there's only one king, one true king in the entire Torah, and that is God. The one true and only God. Yud-Heh-Lo-Heh is the spelling of his name in biblical Hebrew. Okay? There's only one real king, and so these other vassal treaties and suzerainty treaties and parity treaties and all these political treaties of kings are really null and void. They're really the nothing but the selfish workings of human beings who are just really doing this and not out of kindness to their fellow human beings, but out of enlightened self-interest so they can get something out of it, get some kind of political or economic benefit out of it. So, aside from that, these other treaties, these other covenants in the ancient Near East did not have law codes incorporated within them. The whole Israelite covenant, especially the Mosaic part, features prominently a law code, a humanizing manner of conduct that requires each human being to have a proper way of responsibly behaving toward God and toward one's fellow human beings. So this invention of the ancient Israelite, okay, humanly speaking here, inspired by God, but on a human level, speaks to people in the ancient Near East, to their cultural situation, through their cultural lingo, but basically it's really counterculture. It's saying that what's going on politically and religiously in the ancient Near East is really off the mark and needs serious reformation, it needs serious correction. And so here is a radically different way of dealing with life and dealing with religion and belief in God, in the divine world. And at the same time, it speaks to ancient Near Eastern people because it understands and uses their type of verbiage and frames of reference. as to how to go about things. In other words, to convey the idea of the kingship of the one true God, then this ancient Near Eastern model, okay, sort of brings to mind to the average, right, this ancient Near Eastern background. And then it gives the ancient Israelite, and hopefully gives us now, okay, the opportunity to say, ha, wow, Baruch Hashem, Baruch Yahweh, this is so radically different, this is refreshing, this is healing, this is so beneficial, this is so superior to anything else that's going on. Okay? In other words, it's a divinely inspired text, but it's not, in my opinion, a magical text. It is a text spoken to human beings. And the way human beings understand literature and language, including the language of covenant, is to understand things in their social, cultural, and historical context. So that's why I'm raising this issue of the structure, the formal structure of the covenant. What I mean by formal structure is simply the way people in the ancient Near East, or the way people today, construct legal documents or can even write a letter. If you have Microsoft Word or some other WordPerfect or some other kind of word processor, it's going to give you a template for certain kinds of documents. It'll give you a resume template. It'll give you a letter template. Okay? This is what I mean by formal structure. That has nothing to do with the content. The content can be good or bad. The content of a letter can be godly or ungodly. But the formal structure of a letter, with the date on the top and the name and address of the addressee on the top left-hand side of the paper, followed by Dear Sirs or Dear Madam or Dear Ms. or to whom it may concern, and then signed at the bottom, sincerely yours, so-and-so. Okay, this is the formal structure. So that's what I mean by formal structure. So that part, I believe, can be compared to other documents and other covenant makings in the ancient Near East. And if we understand that, then we can get an idea, flavor for how radically different and positive this covenant structure in the Torah is. Now, in the book of Deuteronomy, we can see this covenant structure rather blatantly. I'll get back to Exodus and Leviticus on this after we deal with Deuteronomy. I think it's more obvious in Deuteronomy, but it does exist also in Exodus and Leviticus. Okay? So we have covenant structure number one. We have an identification of who's speaking in the covenant. Okay? And so these are the words which Moses spoke to the children of Israel. Okay? And we have then we're given the location. So this covenant has got to do with Moses as the representative of God and the children of Israel. Right, so the parties are identified. There's further identification of the parties more explicitly involving God in chapter 1, verse 6, where it says, Yud-Heh Vol-Heh, our God spoke to us on Horeb, that is on Mount Sinai, and so on and so forth. Okay, so this covenant of the book of Deuteronomy, this covenant writing, is between Yahweh and the children of Israel, with Moses as the vehicle for explaining the covenant to the children of Israel. So then it proceeds with a retrospective speech by Moses. Moses in some sense, may be incorporating his memoirs as he gives instruction to the children of Israel. Because there's a very personalized account where we see Moses speaking in the third person. And, you know, in the rest of the books of the Torah, you know, in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, where it says, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel. And then it would say, and Moses spoke to the children of Israel. Moses did this, Moses did that. That's speaking in the third person. Here, it changes to the first person. Moses says, I did this, and I did this. And when you grumble, then I, Yahweh, your God, on your behalf, and I then heard the voice of God, and so on and so on, so it's a very personalized account here in Deuteronomy. Okay, now, after the identification of the parties, we have here Moses' historical account of the dealings between God and the children of Israel, and to a certain extent between God and Moses, the intermediary of the covenant. So Moses in chapter 1 verse 9 states that he had a very personal difficulty, and so he recalls that he had complained to God that the burden of leading the children of Israel was too heavy for him to take alone, and so God set apart the elders of the community and so forth. And okay, so this is a benefit to the people, it's also a benefit to Moses, but it shows God's wisdom in dealing this large people. And so then Moses then describes how he took heads of your tribes and so on and so forth, and this is the beginnings of the Israelite legal system, the judiciary. And then Moses in verse 19 continues the historical narrative, saying, we journeyed from Horeb, from Mount Sinai, into the awesome wilderness, and so on. And then it goes on to explain how God delivered the children of Israel from the hand of the Amorites and caused the children of Israel to inherit the Amorite territory. And so here it's showing that God is covenant loyal, that God is faithful, God has kept his part of the bargain, and that God also will fulfill all of his part of the covenant bargain. This victory over the Amorites is just due to God's fulfilling his covenant promise by bringing the children of Israel into the land of Canaan, as God promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Okay, and so we see this land of promise theme again all throughout the book of Deuteronomy, hearkening back to God's promise to Abraham in Genesis 15. Now, this fairly lengthy historical discourse continues on, and so this is sort of the you might say the preamble to the actual covenant content. In other words, this historical recollection of this intimate and important unbreakable relationship between the parties. And so no wonder it's a time for making covenant between God and the people of Israel, because God is the people of Israel, despite its things, and so Israel should be overjoyed to bind themselves to this covenant with Yud-Heh, Woh-Heh. Okay, because God has been so faithful. And so we move forward. To verse 18. And we see again a connective to the Abrahamic covenant and its promise of the land of Israel, where Moses says, and then I commanded you at that time, saying, Yahweh, your God, gave to you this land to inherit. And then so on and so forth. Okay, and then it says you shall crossover armed and so on and so forth and so on and so forth. Okay, and overcome giants that are in the land and so on and so on. Okay, so then God says that he is going to give the Israelites success in realizing the fulfillment of his promise to Abraham. In verse 21, God commands Joshua, to be the leader of the army, and so on and so forth, and that God will wage war for you. God will be with you in battle. Okay? Yes, and thank you, Mogrilli Man, for giving us English of some of the scripture verses. Okay, I think that's helpful. Thank you. So, now, continuing on, in chapter 4 of the book of Deuteronomy, we have the beginning of the legal section of the book. Now, the first several chapters of the legal section of the book give very, very few specific commandments. They are mainly chapters which continue to charge the people of Israel, to exhort the people of Israel to obey all of God's commandments without explicitly stating what all those commandments are. Of course, many commandments have already been given in the books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. So Deuteronomy is recalling those commandments, but in terms of the covenant structure here of just the book of Deuteronomy, which I think has a covenant structure of itself, independently of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, although I'm not saying the commandments are independent, but as a scroll, it's given as an entire covenant in itself. And so, starting in chapter 4, verse 1, it says, "So now, Israel, hearken, listen attentively to the statutes and to the fitting rules, the judgments, which I teach you to perform, so that you will live, and you will enter, and you will inherit the land which Yahweh, the God of your forefathers, gave to you." Again, right back to Genesis 15. "Do not add any word, any matter, anything. Do not add anything to what I command you. And do not subtract from it. But rather to perform the commandments of Yahweh, your God, which I command you this day." Okay? So here we have the general legal exhortation and the general principles of how this law operates. Okay? There is interspersed in this period, in this section, some continued retrospective history here. This is the main theme of this section of Deuteronomy. Okay, again in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 5, it says, "See, I have taught you statutes and judgments." And so on. Okay. And Moses, with Moses speaking, he says, "Just as Yahweh has commanded me," and so forth. And so then, if we can say that there is one single commandment in this section, then other than just general exhortations to obey all of God's commandments, we can say that it is a constant reiteration of the fact that only Yahweh is God and that there is no other. So, for example, in chapter 4, verse 35, it says, "You have been shown so that you will know that Yahweh, He is the God. There is none else beside Him." There is none else other than Him. Okay? So, this forms again, a general legal principle that this covenant works because the only God who is really God, that is Yahweh, has commanded these principles and these actions and these do's and don'ts. Therefore, this covenant is valid. Now, in chapter 5, we come to the so-called Ten Commandments, or what I would prefer to call the ten statements, or ten general principles of law. This is entirely consistent with my statement before about ancient Near Eastern covenants having a two-part legal section, the first part being general legal principles and only getting the specifics in the second part. These 10 statements are 10 general principles of law upon which many other laws will depend. Okay? So, in my opinion, that still fits in with the more general section, the section of more general legal principles. Okay? Now, this continues until we get to chapter 12. And I will say that at the end of chapter 11, we have an interlude here, which in the ancient Near Eastern covenants wouldn't really fit exactly in this place, but, and that is the idea of blessing and cursing. In the ancient Near Eastern covenants, this only comes right near the end. Here it's sort of stuck in the middle, but we'll have much more important statements about blessing and cursing at the end of Deuteronomy, which does fit in with the ancient Near Eastern covenant structure. Perhaps it's put here in the middle of Deuteronomy as a transition between the general legal section and the more specific legal section. So, starting in verse 12, we have the beginning of the specific legal section, where laws are explained, not as mere general principles, but details are given. So it says that these are the statutes and the judgments which you shall observe to perform in the land which Yahweh, the God of your forefathers, gives to you to inherit all the days, all of your days, all of the days which you live on the earth. So, we have enumeration of many, many commandments. Okay, is that when you enter the land of Israel, the land of Canaan, you shall utterly destroy all the places which the nations worship their gods, destroy their altars, and their pagan sanctuaries, and do not imitate their manner of worshiping gods. Don't worship Yahweh your God in the same manner that the pagans worship their gods, and so on. Then it will go on about in chapter 12 about proper slaughter of animals and what you can eat and what you can't eat and the separation of tithes and again in chapter 13 laws against idolatry. In chapter 14, more specific laws about what animals may be eaten and what may not be eaten. In chapter 15, we have provisions for the poor, the Shemitah, the year of remission, and the seventh year of the release of debts, and the treatment of Hebrew indentured servants and foreign slaves, dealing with the giving of the firstborn of the cattle and of the flock to the priests, and the set times, the appointed times in Deuteronomy 16, the festival calendar, and then at the end of chapter 16, and in chapter 17, we have the more formal establishment of the Israelite judicial system to be worked out in the land of Israel. And then in chapter 18, we have various laws for the Levites and so on, and in the Levitical cities. Chapter 19, various capital cases. Okay, chapter 20. I know I'm going through this very quickly, but I just want to give you the idea of the specificity of these types of laws. Chapter 20, we have laws for war. In chapter 21, we have laws for the dealing with an unidentified corpse. And again, some more laws relating to wars, including that young people who are just married shouldn't go out to war, but should stay home for a year so they can enjoy being married and make that marital adjustment without the interruption of going out to war, and so on. We have in chapter 22, verse 1, a law that says that if you see the ox of your brother or his goat or his sheep or his goat, wandering off and so forth, you shall return that to your brother, and so on, and various other aspects of kindness, and then a number of other laws regarding what to do with a bird's nest, and building a parapet around a roof to as a protection for visitors, and so on and so forth. So all these laws get specific about how Israelites are to behave. And this is the central core, of course, of the covenant in Deuteronomy. And this continues all the way through chapter 27, or actually through chapter 26. And in chapter 27, then we have a ceremony for declaring blessings and curses. Okay. And this is on Mount Ebal in the land of Israel, and on Mount Gerizim. Okay? So this is sort of an instruction that God gives to Joshua to have done once Joshua leads the people of Israel into the promised land. So it becomes sort of a fitting introduction to the more formal blessings and curses section of this covenant document of Deuteronomy. So starting in chapter 28, verse 1. And it shall be that if you surely, carefully hearken to the voice of Yahweh your God to perform, to safeguard, to perform, to carefully perform all of his commandments which I command you, then Yahweh your God will make you or place you as the highest above all the nations of the earth. And all of the commandments, all of these blessings will come upon you and overtake you if you hearken to the voice of Yahweh your God. And then blessed shall you be in the city, blessed shall you be in the field, blessed shall be the fruit of your womb and the fruit of your kneading trough. I'm sorry, and the fruit of your soil and the fruit of your animals, and so on and so forth. The fruit of your bread basket and the fruit of your kneading trough and so on and so forth. Okay, so then this fairly lengthy list of blessings is followed by an even longer list of curses for non-compliance with the covenant, starting in verse 15. But if you will not hearken to the voice of Yahweh your God to be careful to observe all of his commandments and his statutes, which I command you this day, then all of these curses shall come upon you and overtake you, and so on and so forth. And most of them are just the reversals of all the covenant blessings. So, then we proceed to the final structures found in the covenant. In chapters 29 and 30, we have an additional plea for compliance with the covenant. And chapter 29 reiterates the consequences for failure to comply with the covenant. Chapter 30 states that if you comply with the covenant, that God is going to bring back you. And an exhortation for the community to embrace the covenant, but also for each individual to embrace the covenant. So it says here that this is chapter 30 of Deuteronomy, verse 1. When all of these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse, which I place before you, and you return to your heart. What does that mean? It really, I think, means that you turn it over in your heart. That it revolves around and around and around in your heart. That you're really making an effort to consider these things that have come upon you. In other words, the exhortation here is to look upon what has happened up till now. From the time of the giving of the Sinai covenant to the present. And you turn these things over in your heart. You consider them carefully. Among all the nations to which Yahweh your God scattered you, and you return unto Yahweh your God, and you hearken to his voice according to all of that which I am commanding you this day, according to all of that which I am commanding you this day. So not which God is commanding through some other covenant or some other group of officials, but which I am commanding you this day. You and your children, with all of your heart and with all of your soul, all of your life, energy, hear me. I think I apologize for the technical difficulties. Also, been going on for quite a long time, so I'm going to wrap up this section. But there are a couple of just a few quick points I want to make. You know, that'll conclude this section. And can someone just clue me in as to what was the last thing that I said? Wrap up this section. I want to get to just quickly all the covenant parts. In chapter 31 of Deuteronomy, we see that provision is made for a successor to Moses, that is Joshua. And so Joshua, in some sense, becomes not only a leader of Israel, but a continuator of the covenant. And as we see also in chapter 31, verse 9, that Moses wrote this Torah. So the Torah that's available is the one that's written. There is no oral Torah that is spoken of. The Torah is known. It's not the property of a certain group of people, inside of Israel or outside of Israel. It is the property ultimately of God and of the whole covenant people as a covenant people. It is under the safeguard of the priests, but that's a whole other topic. But the covenant is available. It's in the sanctuary of God, and Moses writes down this entire covenant. Okay, again, in go to verse 9 of Deuteronomy. And Moses wrote this Torah and gave it to the priests, the sons of Levi, who are the bearers of the Ark of the Covenant, and to all the elders of Israel. So we see that, again, there's a connection between the sanctuary and the priests who are the servants of the sanctuary, the servants of God in the sanctuary, and the presence of God in the sanctuary, and this covenant writing. Now, copies of this scroll are also given to the elders of Israel, because the elders are in charge of giving judgment, of adjudicating cases in the gates of the cities and towns of Israel, and they need this writing as their guide. So the covenant writing in the temple, and then going out to other people outside of the temple precincts, is the image that I think that is the structure of things, where the holiness of the sanctuary radiates out from the temple to the entire earth, to all persons who want to partake of it, and the covenant in writing is deposited in the temple and radiates out from the holiness of the temple and spreads out through the entire earth. But it always maintains this sanctuary connection, even theoretically in the absence of the sanctuary as we have today. Okay, now, going on ahead to chapter 31, verse 24, we see again that Moses finished writing all of the words of the Torah. Okay, I'll translate the verse. And it was when Moses finished writing the words of this Torah on a scroll, as a witness unto, unto its completion. The Hebrew here, ad tumam, unto its perfection, unto everything else. In other words, it's not going to be added or subtracted from, added to or subtracted from. It's a completeness. Then Moses commanded the Levites, the bearers of the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh, saying, take this scroll of the Torah, and you shall place it beside the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh your God, and it shall be there for you as a witness. In other words, this is an available thing. It is not a secret code. It is available for all who want to participate in the covenant. And then, finally, as we had mentioned, in ancient Near Eastern covenants, there was a provision for the public reading of the covenant every so often, so that people would be reminded of the covenant terms, be reminded of what their obligations under the covenant were. And so in chapter 31 of Deuteronomy, we have the commandment that at the end of 7 years, at the time of the sabbatical year, which in Leviticus we learn, at least the Jubilee is taken at the time of the Day of Atonement. Okay, I was thinking of something else there. Okay, the Jubilee is taken from year to year at the time of the Day of Atonement. But on the Feast of Tabernacles, the Festival of Sukkot, is the reading in every sabbatical year, the reading of the entire scroll of the covenant in the hearing of all the Israelites, all the participants in the covenant. So we have here a covenant that is conveyed in a certain kind of way, which I think has its own message. In other words, the way of structuring the covenant has a message beyond the mere contents of the covenant. In other words, these laws could have been given just as a list of laws rather than as a covenant. So what does God say to us through that covenant format? Number one, as we had discovered in our looking at the covenant of Noah in Genesis chapter 9, that there were all these relational terms based on the Hebrew word et, aleph, tau, with you, with. And so God is establishing a relationship, and that relationship is a relationship of righteousness or righteous doing, tzedakah, and of covenant loyalty, chesed. And so, therefore, this is not simply a laundry list of things to do, but an active, daily, moment-by-moment relationship between the individual who is living according to the covenant and God, and between the community and God. The second thing that I think that the covenant format tells us is that this is really a counterculture. Here we have God speaking to the children of Israel in a manner that is in some ways very similar culturally and in terms of writing formats to other ancient Near Eastern cults, a very banal and base, selfishly motivated codes that even came about as a result of violence, unjust violence, in ancient Near Eastern political history. So here, that language and that format, and in this sense, it was really simply like the format, the covenant format here is basically like a Microsoft Word template for a letter or a resume, okay, that says nothing good or bad about the content. It just says something about the form. But everything here being inspired by God, we can say that then there is a message in the form. And I think one of the messages in the form is that this is a counterculture. It's speaking to and through a form, a format, prevalent in ancient Near Eastern culture, and yet at the same time, taking that and throwing it, overturning it, turning it head over heels, saying that what is represented in those ancient Near Eastern covenants is base, ugly, unacceptable. Here, in the Israelite covenant, only God is king and God is just. His motives are not base. His motives are out of love, care, and for instructing human beings in what truly gives them spiritual life And if they do this corporately, they'll have emotional and physical life to go along with it. That God's kingdom is not like the kingdom of the world. God's kingdom breaks into this world and changes this world. But it is not like the devices of human beings. And so, I would leave us with the thought that this covenant structure contains a message of that relationship between God and his people, and that the design here is in part to create a culture which is imbued with God's presence and walks and lives according to God's law. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you for listening. Oh no, what is the problem here? What is the matter with this?
Thanks. 'Festival.' There was a recent dig about a year ago at a site that's today known as Kerbet Koyafa. I probably butchered that. But at this site in their excavations, they found a partially rendition of Torah in like a layman's words. Just kind of evidence that Torah was quite universal in Israel, even though they worshipped other gods dually with Yahweh. There was knowledge of it and a level of understanding among the common people where it was written. And, they didn't have to rely on sages or anyone else because all the people knew and they had the Levites living among them.
I don't know if you guys remember earlier, it was right in the beginning of the study when David was going through some of the rabbinic writings where the rabbis basically, I guess he said it was in the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud, where they basically stated that they had the right to dictate doctrine, just like the Pope does. Just like the vicar, he can change the day of worship. He can specify. He can create law out of air. And it was interesting. I don't know if you guys heard that earlier. That he was citing parts of the Babylonian and Jerusalem Talmuds where they basically stated that they had the right to invent doctrine. So I thought that was really great to hear. I guess everybody heard it.
I wanted to ask you, David, Brit Shalom, on your study, when you were going over Deuteronomy 4:2, in my English version, it didn't say this day, actually, in the English. I was wondering if it says this day in the Ivrit or the Hebrew.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me? I hope you can hear me. Deuteronomy 4:2. Yeah, I think I had unintentionally inserted this day because that's such a common refrain in Deuteronomy. But you're right. I stand corrected. You know, the it just says, you know, that you shall not add or subtract to the word that I command you. And so on. But so yes, that's correct.
Well, the reason why I was asking you that question, but then later, I think it was in the volume Deuteronomy 31 or 24, one of those two chapters, where it actually did say this day in mine. And what I was asking is, on, because it's Deuteronomy 4:2, and 13:1 in the Hebrew that we use a lot, you know, when we are speaking to the rabbinic crowd, that we're not supposed to add to or subtract from his words. But I hear it a lot said, we're not supposed to subtract from his Torah. And yet, Yahweh does not restrict himself to only saying things to us throughout his Torah, but throughout the entire Tanakh, through the prophets as well. And so I was just wondering if what he said in Deuteronomy 4:2 and 13:1 in the Hebrew, or else the last chapter of 12 in some English translations. I just wondered if it says Torah there, or if it says to my words, not to add or subtract, and if that could mean what he commands us throughout the Tanakh, even via through the prophets.
Yes, okay, that's an excellent point. I'm glad you brought it up. The verse in Deuteronomy chapter 4, that is verse 2, says, what I command you. God says, what I command you, you shall not subtract or add from. Now, the covenant structure that I mentioned before is a entity in and of itself, in my opinion. What I mean by that is that the fundamental basis of God's revelation and God's law is in the Torah, so that these are the covenant behaviors that are required. The covenant do's and don'ts. The role of the later prophets, such as Isaiah and Amos and Jeremiah, was not, in my opinion, to add law, but to clarify the application of the Torah and its implications for their generations, and to exhort the people to embrace the covenant and return to God. So I don't see the prophets giving additional commandments. Even in Jeremiah chapter 17, where it speaks of not going out, not bringing a burden out of your home on the Sabbath day, I don't see it as an additional commandment. I see it as an implication of the meaning of the word work, or malacha in Hebrew, that is forbidden according to the Torah. In other words, this is, if we look at the Torah, we find that gathering, harvesting, things like that are forbidden, skilled laborers and so forth. And so, in Jeremiah's mind, this includes commerce. Burden there doesn't mean any old item, in my opinion. I have a study on this that I've done. That's a whole other talk we won't get to today. But in Hebrew, the word for burden is masa. okay, which comes from the word to carry. But in context, we can see that every time this word is used in Scripture, it means a heavy load, a heavy burden, something that usually has to do with carrying something for a job, such as the Levites having the burden of the tabernacle, carrying it on their shoulders. That was an appointed task. Carrying loads of grain and so forth. And so if we look at this and use all of Scripture to see what Scripture is really talking about, then we find that this is not just carrying any old thing with collecting, gathering, and commercial activity, which I think is clearly prohibited according to Exodus chapters, let's say, 31 through 35.
Thank you, David. I guess what I'm actually asking is, does it actually say, do not add to or take away anything from my Torah? Or does it say from my words? Because mine is translated as my words, which I speak to you this day. Or which I speak to you, not this day isn't there. And so, like, for example, Yeshayahu, Isaiah 58, where he further explains well, that is Yeshayahu speaking, though, but I don't know, there's places where throughout the Tanakh and the prophets and stuff, Yahuwah is quoted by the prophet as to what he said, and it might be a further explanation, more information on what he stated in Torah. And so I guess what I'm saying is I'm trying to figure out what the Hebrew actually says there, because there's a lot of people that are, at least I've run across now, that are saying only the Torah is Yahweh's words, and the rest are just man's words and don't have to be followed like the Torah. We can just exclude it and just go by Torah alone. So I'm just wondering how to answer them.
Yeah, the way I would answer that briefly is that if we look in Numbers chapter 11, where Aaron and Miriam are complaining about Moses' Cushite wife and so forth, and then God in that context says that he speaks to Moses face to face, but God also mentions that he speaks to other prophets in a vision or a dream. Okay? Also in Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 15, for example, it says that God will raise up unto you a prophet like me, that is a prophet like Moses, and you shall hearken to him. Okay, and so forth. So, there are other prophets, not just Moses, and those prophets have important messages, and as I said, they exhort people to come back to the covenant. And they teach the people how to apply the covenant in real historical circumstances, but they don't add to the covenant. Their words are holy because they're inspired by God, but they're more situational than the Torah. They're more directed into real life circumstances in the history of the people of Israel. So, back to Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 2. Let me give a literal translation of this. And the verse says, you shall not add upon the word which I am commanding you, do not subtract from it, so as to observe the commandments of Yahweh your God, which I am commanding you. So the reason that I read that slowly was to hear each word. In other words, it's not which I have commanded you, but which I am commanding you. I am in the process of commanding you. So there's a sense of continuation there. And so I think it's referring to everything that God is speaking, at least in the book of Deuteronomy and in the Torah in general. That's my sense of it. In chapter 13 of Deuteronomy, I think it's got more to do with the idolatry issue that's going on there. But here, I think that just the way the grammar comes across in the Hebrew suggests that it's talking about everything that's being commanded according to the covenant.